is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community station, KBOO. Thanks for everybody who participated. I really hope you go to kbo.fm /audio, I believe. Look up this program, Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm going to have a lot of links to a lot of interesting stuff. Read it. Talk about it. See you next time.
We set off to join the picket lines, but together we cannot fail. We got stopped by police at the county line. They said, go on, boys, or you'll go into jail. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Well, it's hard to explain to a crying child why her daddy won't go back. So the family suffer, but it hurts me more to hear a scab say, sod you, Jack. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys?
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO. Political perspectives. We hear the ecology of a police state, a panel from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference, which explores the intersections between the epidemic of mass incarcerations and the environmental degradation, which occurs directly and indirectly as a result of it. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Her guest is activist David Cobb, National Projects Director of Democracy Unlimited. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, we feature an update from the ground in Baltimore. Also, tragedy in Nepal. We'll have two reports about the unfolding situation in that nation. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Gene Bradley speaks with Dr. Tor Hansen about his new book, the book, The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pigs Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. And 11:30, we hear an excerpt from Radio Echo Shock featuring an interview with George Karunas of Angry Planet and the solar-powered international musician known as Tortuga Blanku. And thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, political perspective. Today's program features a panel discussion from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference on the ecology of a police state. The panelists are Paul Wright. That's coming up next, right after these messages.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What are the candidates saying?
My name is Bobby Regan, and I'm excited to be running for the school board in Zone 3 because I believe in public education, and I believe that every child has the capacity to succeed at high levels. My highest priority is to get our graduation rate up.
Tune into KBOO April 27th through the 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's membership director. I want to thank you for being a member and a listener to KBOO. I also wanted to share this listener's comment on why they support KBOO.
Thanks, KBOO, for true diversity, high-quality community service, and for birthing KMUN Community Radio in Astoria 31 years ago. Carol, Astoria, Oregon.
We hope that you feel the same. Please support your community and your local radio station by going to kboo.fm/give.
And welcome to Political Perspectives. Today's program features a panel discussion from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference on the ecology of a police state. The panelists are Paul Wright, founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and editor of Prison Legal News, Max Rameau, director of the Center for Pan-African Development, Ben Rosenfeld, attorney and board member of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, Keon Mallory, and associate professor of environmental philosophy at Villanova University. And the moderator is Panagiotis Tsokas. Here he is introducing the panel.
Welcome to the Ecology of a Police State panel. My name is Panayoti Cholkis, and I'm going to be moderating the panel. I'm going to give a little bit of introduction, and then I'm going to hand it off to the panelists here. We have a lot to pack in to a relatively short time, so we realize we're going to be kind of skimming the surface and the topic of the intersections between the criminal justice system and the environmental movement, and exploring really where we could go to build that into a social force that could really change the dynamics in this country. Environmental pollution and mass incarceration, I think, in my opinion, are among the most fundamental examples of injustice in the U.S. And, you know, academic research has shown that a narrow focus on nature is a weak point in the environmental movement. And there's some great thought and study that have gone into that. And the EPA data that we've looked at has shown that environmental regulation is actually a weak point in the prison system. And Prison Legal News, a magazine you may have seen, it's been coming out for 25 years, has done some incredible research, just scratching the surface at looking at the environmental impact of prisons. There's also been local campaigns that have popped off around the country looking at where specific prisons have caused problems. But what we want to do is really create sort of a new school of thought or a new concept that we're calling the prison ecology, which is that there's a unique reality of prisons, and it's almost paralleled by the regulation scene just south of the Mexican border in North America, where the world of prisons is, you know, it's almost off the map and ignored, both in terms of human rights and labor standards, but also environmental standards. And so we're going to scratch the surface on that, but really look at a wider picture. Why are prisons overpopulated? Why do they exist in the first place? What is the police state? And how did this thing come about? We're going to look at from, you know, endangered species impact to, you know, to environmental justice concerns. So the question that this panel is really asking is, how do we build the bridge between these two issues? And more specifically, can we help prisoners see themselves as part of the environmental movement? And can we get environmentalists to view themselves as criminal justice reformers and, even better, maybe prison abolitionists? With that, I'm going to pass it off to Paul Wright, who is the editor of Prison Legal News and the director of the Human Rights Defense Center.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out to hear the panel and for showing up. And we've also got a website that has the biggest collection of criminal justice-related and prison-related articles and content on the website, including on the issue of the environment in prison. There's a criminologist in California, Jonathan Simon, and he wrote a book called Governing Through Crime, and he refers to prisons as toxic waste dumps. And he's doing so in kind of the metaphorical sense of, you know, referring to human toxic waste. And Jonathan and I are friends, and after his book came out, I told him, you know, it's a good analogy that you're drawing here, but you've also got the reality that many prisons are literally toxic dumps. They're toxic waste sites before they built prisons on there. I think a lot of people are well aware of the fact that the United States leads the world in mass incarceration. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. We've got any given day around 2.5 million people locked up in this country. And the big thing is that the U.S. prison population grew by 500% between 1980 and around 2010. So over that 40-year period, we saw massive growth in the U.S. prison population. And during the 1990s, in that time period, especially in the 1990s, the United States built over 1,500 prisons. And the big thing is, okay, where were these prisons built? Virtually all of them were built in rural areas. And one of the things that we find is that a lot of them were literally built on toxic waste sites. Several prisons have been built on EPA Superfund sites. We have prisons in, especially in Pennsylvania and Ohio, for example, that were built on abandoned coal mines. And then we have the spectacle, like 5-10 years after these prisons are built, the ground is settling underneath them, so the prisons are literally collapsing, which I think is a great thing. And, you know, and of course, I don't know anything about coal mining, but to me it seems like a really bad idea to build anything on top of an abandoned coal mine where you've dug around in the ground underneath it. But
They could get tunnels easier to prisoners.
Yes.
use those old mine shafts.
And you know, when we talk about the toxic waste analogy here, is everyone's heard of Rikers Island in New York. So New York City, it's our biggest city in the United States, the world center of finance and capitalism, and the prison there is, on Rikers Island is the jail. It's literally built on a landfill in the middle of the Hudson River, and they have methane leaks. So periodically they have explosions where, you know, entire rooms will just be blown out caused by the methane and that, and everyone thinks this is okay. A lot of prisons were also built on abandoned military bases in the 90s and 2000s as the United States shut down a lot of its military bases. Rather than shut them down entirely, they repurposed them. And a lot of these bases are also toxic waste sites that have been contaminated by decades of spillages of jet fuel, diesel, and other toxic chemicals by the military. The BOPs, that's the Federal Bureau of Prisons, their flagship facility in Florence, Colorado, that houses the their supermax prison known as the ADX, where they house high-profile political prisoners and prisoners that the United States government is really mad at. And that's built on an abandoned uranium mine. And this leads to the kind of foreseeable consequences that these prisons have contaminated water supplies. The entire prisons themselves are contaminated. And I think one of the differences with this type of environmental contamination is that people outside of prison, if you live in a contaminated waste site or an area with environmental issues, you do have the option of moving. You can say, you know what, I really don't like having diesel in my water. I really don't like the MCBs in the water from the fracking or whatever, so I think I'm going to go somewhere else. But in the prison environment, people are literally brought there in chains and held at gunpoint. They don't have that option. And often they're being held in these same prisons for years on end. And we have the Kern County Prison or the Kern State Prison in California. They have extremely high levels of arsenic in the water there. And they tell the prisoners this, and of course they don't give them bottled water. They've built the prison there, and the prisoners are being forced to drink the water. And this is a story that plays itself out all over the United States in hundreds of prisons. And part of the thing we've also got is we've got kind of a dearth of data in the sense of we know it's an issue. No one really knows even how widespread it is or even how big of an issue it is because the research just hasn't been done. This is just kind of the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Then we've also got prisons themselves as the source of toxic waste and sewage. One of the things that happened is they built 1,500 prisons in the United States in the last 30 years, but they didn't build enough of them. So prisons that were built originally to house, say, for example, in California, they built prisons to house 2,000-3,000 prisoners, and that was their rated capacity. They built water treatment plants to handle the sewage of that number of prisoners, and then they decided to overcrowd the facility. So instead of 3,000 prisoners, the facility will now house 5,000-7,000, and they didn't increase the sewage treatment capacity of the prisons. So you have the reality around the country where overcrowded prisons are dumping pretty huge amounts of raw untreated sewage into neighboring water supplies around the facilities and around the prisons. We also see a lot of cases where the prisons, in addition to dumping raw sewage, they also have prison industry sites. They also have industrial manufacturing, which, to use Paniotti's example of the Maquiladora example from of South America, where it's largely unregulated, it's uncontrolled. In addition to raw sewage, are dumping all these toxic chemicals into the surrounding environment. And I think one of the things that's interesting too is that it's this prison building program. A lot of these prisons were built in poor, white, rural areas where, ironically enough, the reason they were built was to use them as engines of economic development after extractive industries had destroyed the environment. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we see in Clallam Bay, Washington, for example, and Aberdeen, Washington, they built prisons in abandoned mining towns. After they'd clear-cut the forest, they'd cut down every last tree that could be cut down, and it's like, okay, the jobs are gone, the trees are gone. Well, now what are we going to do? Well, hey, we'll build a prison. And that's what they've done. And this has happened around the country where there is a very finite and a very real connection between the environment, environmental degradation, and in some ways continuing this through the criminal justice system and through the prison system. And I think that one of the other things that we also have, too, that is also kind of it's amazing that few people have thought about this, is especially in California and the state of Arizona. They build a large number of these maximum security prisons in very pristine, fragile desert environments. In Arizona, they built a number of prisons there. In California, they built them in the high Sierras like Susanville and places like that. And I first started thinking about this when I was reading a book that was called The Scientist in the Yard. And the book was about a prisoner. He'd been a high school science teacher. He'd been convicted of having sex with one of his students, and he went to prison, and he writes a book where he talks about being in the prison yard and finding an endangered toad in the yard, and talking about your science in everywhere. And I'm kind of thinking to myself, whose idea was it to build the maximum security prison in an environmentally sensitive area with endangered species in it? And that's one of the things that is the large unasked question is, you know, why were these prisons built in such fragile areas, and the impact that they're having on the environment in these places. And one of the things that I also find alarming is that on the one hand, we have lots of facts, we have lots of knowledge that these prisons are actually sources of toxic waste, they're destroying the environment around them, even to the extent they've already been built on environmentally damaged and fragile places. But then on the other hand, the government is not sitting silent, or they're not standing still on this, but they've actually started this process of greenwashing mass incarceration. And one of the things that really gets me going is when I see these articles and, you know, where the media is really falling all over themselves, you know, wow, this prison just installed solar panels to cut their energy dependence. And I'm kind of like, this would be like the Germans are saying, hey, we've got some really gas-efficient crematorium at Auschwitz, you know. This is not a good thing. I mean, you really don't want to have, you know, necessarily an energy-efficient machine of mass incarceration. And a lot of prisons are also taking the lead in LEED certifications, certifying how environmentally friendly, like control units and long-term solitary confinement prisons are. And we're seeing this where they're co-opting the rhetoric of the green and the environmental movement. And largely, this is not being challenged by anyone. There's also occasionally you'll see cases where they use prison slave labor. They use unpaid prisoners for so-called environmental projects where, hey, we're doing a compost thing, and we've got 10 prisoners doing this for 10 cents an hour. And, you know, and I think this is one of the things where we're seeing a lot of the co-optation of the language and the rhetoric of the environmental movement being used to further an agenda of mass incarceration, massive violations of human rights, and it's not being challenged. There's a couple other issues as well, including especially in the Atlantic and the Northeast, where you have a lot of older prisons where they use coal-fired plants to heat prisons. You've got asbestos contamination within prisons and a lot of other issues. This is enough to give you, I think, a little bit of an overall framework of kind of the fact-based reality of what's going on. We have a lot more of this stuff on our website at prisonlegalnews.org. You can do word searches on all this stuff. But I think one of the things I'd like to emphasize is that one of the things that permeates the entire criminal justice system in this country is, number one, a lack of transparency. We know very little about what's going on here. Most people have a better idea of what's going on in North Korea than they do what's going on in the prison or the jail, you know, miles from their house. And there's a reason for that. The other thing that goes with the lack of transparency is the lack of accountability. People die, people get killed, our environment's being destroyed, and no one is responsible, and no one is held accountable for it. Those are the two initial problems, and those are two of the problems that we'd like to start changing and start seeing some solutions to. So, thank you.
Welcome to everybody. Thanks to Paul for setting up this really great panel. Thanks to my colleagues for being here. Thanks to you for joining us today. Thanks also to the people of Oregon who've set up space like this for all of us to come together and have these really important conversations. I am somebody who comes from the perspective of the movement for human rights for people that are incarcerated, that are enslaved behind walls. And I've been doing that for 20 years, and about 10 years ago, I decided that it was time to stop going into debt $3,000 a year because there's no money to be made. So you have to find a way to make money. So I went and got a PhD and got a job as a professor where I teach now at Chico State, and I do research around penal abolition, which is the very simple but highly intelligent idea that we need to entirely rethink how we do community relationships. Hallelujah. When Paul approached me about joining this panel, I thought, well, what the hell do I know about the environmental movement beyond, you know, being an educated person around issues like that? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that there's a deep commonality between, as he was, of course, a mile ahead of us, thinking and saying we need to get together and talk about these issues together. There's a deep commonality between these issues. And one way that I'm going to talk to you about it today is put forward some ideas, is how there is, between these two areas, there's this shared notion of the discarded person when you're talking about discarded human beings in the criminal justice system, and also the discarded space that we talk about in the environmental movement. The idea of the discarded person, the social construction of the discarded person, is something that we observe all the time, all around us. It's not just the quote-unquote criminal, but it's also the homeless person in the street. It's also the poor who are receiving so very little of our public good consideration. It's basically anybody who's not white. It's basically anybody who's choosing to live an alternative lifestyle, essentially in any way off the grid. And it's not so much that there is this categorical difference between the normal person and all these other people, as much as it is a perception of difference, a perception of these huge spaces in between us. The conception of the criminal is perhaps the most fantastical fiction in the history of humanity. And I know a lot of people are sitting here going, boy, is he nuts. I've got neighborhoods for him to go to. But actually, here are the facts. You take the collection of human behavior, pretend it's like this. There is a tiny sliver on one side of people who never commit crimes, so-called crimes. And there is a tiny sliver over here of people who do commit crimes, and repeatedly and a lot. And everybody else is actually in this vast land in between. And if you're thinking not, I can only give you a few quick and brief examples. One out of four women in this society will be sexually assaulted in their lifespan. That's one out of four women. Most Americans will experiment with illegal drugs. Yeah. Right? A nonviolent crime. So the idea here of the criminal is enormously fictitious, despite the fact that most of your television programs are organized around these images that are now lost in the public imagination. In fact, lost in the imagination of most people who make money off the system, whether as academics or as prison guards, because it's just been so profoundly distorted. The notion of the discarded space is in many ways similar. I like to think of it as sort of this idea of land of no use, an abandoned industrial site, a landfill for our garbage, a spaces for toxic disposal, a prison, in a city, the alley. No matter where we are, we have these ideas of discarded spaces. And what's interesting now is to put these two ideas together. The idea of the discarded person and the discarded space. And, of course, nowhere does it find better expression than in the prison, because that is where they meet. The prison itself, which actually dates only to a little bit over 200 years ago, the idea of confining somebody lives a lot longer than that. But the idea of an organized institution is incredibly recent, and, of course, will become a matter of history in time. But its very invention, of course, as usual, a bunch of do-gooders started all the trouble, the Quakers, right? They wanted to walk away from all the physical punishment that was happening in society, extra use of the death penalty, corporal punishment. So they decided, what better thing to do than to create a house where you could put people, give them good Bible study, let them sit in quietude in the cell like the monks did, and let them reflect upon their sins, etc. And this was the beginning of the first jail in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, USA, the Walnut Street Jail. When the idea really got grabbed after that, it got grabbed and got placed in the most useless spaces, conception of useless spaces. And those were mine pits, those were abandoned ships, and those were abandoned lands or wasted lands or lands of no value like Australia. penal colony, remember, is how it began. Or the tip of South America, also how the use of that land began. Think of what happens to people when they leave the prison. Right? They're put in, the discarded people are put in this place. But then think about where they go when they leave. But when they leave, they're thrown to the outskirts of society. Actually, many of them, so-called sex offenders, are so restricted in places of where they can live that there are multiple cities in this country where people who have left the prison for a sex offense can only actually legally live under a bridge in the area in which, by parole, they are required to live. And some cities don't even let you do that. To wrap up, I would suggest that we begin to think about penal abolition, which is something that I argue in my own work in terms of how do we start to sort through what it means to, as a community, hold people responsible for their actions, to actually continue to train and educate ourselves to live within the norms that we build for our society. And that the best way to do that is to actually use the idea of difference. Right, to actually recognize that some of us think and act in some ways and some of us think and act in other ways, and that we actually have to leave enough space to do this incredible balancing act, which is always going to be difficult, between valuing all persons, in other words, valuing all actions, while maintaining the social norms. Last sentence, idea, I promise. And also the idea of consequent with that, thinking of spaces is another commonality between these two movements, of thinking of spaces in the same way. All spaces have value inherently. Perhaps we can again use the idea of difference to think about them in different ways, but we have to come up with a way of being with space and a way of being with people that is inclusive and allows worth and value to it all, and them all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ben Rosenfeld. I may have been brought here to give my semi-standard, at least at ELaw, the legal sky is falling on activists talk. But when I started to prepare that, I found it really hard to do so, particularly in the context of both a panel that's focused on a massive social ill of mass incarceration and new Jim Crow, and in the midst of a national dialogue about the discarded person. So I'm going to switch up a little bit and say, first of all, that in contrast to many or even most prison populations, there is no epidemic of incarceration of eco-prisoners, obviously. And yet there is, you know, incredible focus and attention and talk. It's something that our community does incredibly well. I think that fact or that disjunction has a lot of potential. I think it's worth reflecting kind of intensively on that idea for a moment, and that's what I want to do with this talk. There are few convictions in absolute numbers. There are few even majorly dislocating prosecutions that affect or impact people's lives in particularly negative ways, especially compared to the ineffable dislocating effects that rampant oppression and incarceration have on so many other communities. I mean, that's not to say that these aren't very serious cases and extremely egregious cases of government misconduct and entrapment and oppression that have all sorts of chilling effects that reverberate through the communities and take their toll. But that's largely because the cases are notorious, and that's because this is a very empathic movement that leaves nobody behind, and because we do such a good job of broadcasting and rebroadcasting those events and those effects and vociferously decrying government abuse and misconduct. But if you took the temperature of the movement, you know, I think a lot of people would think that those cases are multitudinous, especially if you ask people what they thought about rates of harassment and surveillance generally. Even surveillance is far less rampant, I think, than most people in left-leaning political movements think it is. And yet, you know, that too has its incredibly chilling effect just by virtue of that, again, disjunction between what people think and what the reality is. And so if you look at the government's conduct here, the business of locking up say, a relatively few number of eco-activists and doing it, as I said, in really nefarious ways is sinister for sure, but it's also hyper-rational and logical and extremely effective. And it's been effective, arguably, at deterring the kind of high-profile ELF-type arsons that is what, in a sense, got all of this started, although there's another argument to be made that those had really run their course even before the kind of bulk of the sort of heartland of the Green Scare arrests and prosecutions began. It's been very effective, at least according to some studies, including one by a sociologist named Amory Starr, at chilling people into inaction, perhaps making people stay home, changing the kind of complexion and dynamic and makeup of public street protests, and making it less diverse and less colorful and less family-oriented because people are scared about the results. Certainly, it's tied up and consumed a lot of activist resources, again, I think very significantly to this movement's credit, because it's such an empathic and caring movement and doesn't forget its political prisoners. I could run down a list. I could give you kind of an inventory of the tools that the government uses, even though I think you're probably aware of a lot of them. I mean, it uses fear-mongering and terrorism labeling, which causes judges and juries to leap out of the path of this juggernaut because they don't want to be seen as interfering with a terrorism investigation. It causes judges to abdicate their basic responsibilities of impartiality, if they were ever impartial in the first place, and judicial oversight. We see it through incredibly overbroad investigations that involve a lot of links and network analysis, where the FBI is actually charged with the responsibility more and more under the Attorney General guidelines, which are kind of a government, at least a federal blueprint for investigations. They're designed to check or limit the government, but more and more they've been stood on their head, and really what they are, these tools just for licensing these ever overbroadening investigations that have at their core the mission of doing intelligence. The latest revision of them says that the FBI is an intelligence, not just a law enforcement organization. Certainly includes harassment and grand jury subpoenas. It does include lots of actual surveillance and the perception of surveillance, as I said, that's worse perhaps than it really is. It includes laws and prosecutions which directly attack activists for activism, like the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which gave rise to the Shack 7 prosecutions, which was really just a full frontal attack on the First Amendment. That became the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which has swept up more First Amendment activity into its maw. And it includes enhancements like the mandatory minimum destructive device charge, which was at the core of – really was the cudgel or the hammer that the FBI and prosecutors were able to hold over the heads of the Green Scare defendants in – I want to be careful in saying enforcing them to cooperate, because nothing forced them to cooperate, but it certainly was a major effective tool in prompting the cascade of cooperations that happened. It's important to note that a number of people didn't cooperate. A 30-year mandatory minimum is an incredible hammer to hold over people's heads. And I could go on and on. It includes, of course, the terrorism enhancement, which increases the base offense level and the overall term of incarceration, and has kind of more subtle impacts on how people are housed and where they're assigned. Includes draconian forms of punishment and the housing of some activist brothers and sisters in exquisitely barbaric conditions of confinement, like the communications management units that Daniel McGowan has written about so brilliantly. And it includes almost literally the punishment of thought crime when you consider how low the standard and the bar for the government is to be able to make a successful conspiracy case against somebody. And, ultimately, I think it'd be hard to say that the government doesn't very effectively rely on and use activists' prolific ability to multiply the effectiveness of the government's abuse, again, by so vociferously decrying it in the communities. So if that's true, where do we go from there? What are the effects of that? What are the lessons? How can we pivot from that, maybe to take advantage of that in some sort of effective way? And this is by no means an exhaustive list or observation set of observations, and I'd be very interested in other people's ideas too. But it seems to me that to whatever extent there is this gap between the perception and the reality of the oppression of eco-activists and other radicals, it's a gap that can be filled with more awareness and more activism about this huge social issue, bringing to bear all those incredible tools and resources and abilities that left-leaning activists do have at their disposal and that they have shown they're so effective at using to raise more public awareness and create more solidarity. Really, in essence, I think to spend a kind of privilege, which I think it's important to acknowledge exists, even on the part of people who, it absolutely has to be said, are truly oppressed under the thumbscrews of the government in favor of those people who are even less fortunately situated. And we've seen some really positive examples of this already springing up, where radical activists, eco-activists, anarchist activists make common cause and create solidarity with other groups, for example, in the guise of the Grand Jury Resistance Project in San Francisco, where I'm from, which started out as a union between eco-activists and animal rights activists facing grand jury harassment and repression, and a group of former Black Panthers or then Gray Panthers, the San Francisco Eight, who were suddenly being re-prosecuted or re-investigated for a 1970s era murder of a police officer. And we've seen it in many other places, including in the incredible work of the Sacramento Prisoner Support Group, which also has reached out much more broadly to other afflicted communities. So that's where I would leave it, really for the purpose of trying to start a dialogue around that potentially fertile idea.
So I want to pass it over to Max.
Thank you. So my name is Max Rameau, and just want to spend a few moments talking about the sort of the front end of the ecology, which is the police, and connect the police and the work they do in certain communities and the connection to the ecology. I want to bring up really two main points. One is that the police, as a function in society, their job is to enforce the will and the mores of those who are in charge, of the ruling class. As such, fixing some of the problems that we see with the police state can never happen by addressing the police themselves, because they actually don't make the decisions about what they do. They may make some of the decisions about how they do it, but they don't make those decisions themselves, and therefore we cannot end the police state by addressing the police. We can only end it by addressing those who are in charge of the police. Second point, broader point I want to bring up is in terms of the Black community and the many of the issues we're seeing now, what we've seen for quite a number of years, but coming up now in the news about the police behavior or relationship with the police in our communities. Black communities in the United States serve as a domestic colony, a colony that exists inside of the U.S. And the service as a domestic colony has both economic functions and social functions, social, in this case, meaning race, but certainly economic functions in terms of exploitative low-wage labor, but also exploitative access to the environment, both as a place of taking things and as a place of dumping things, where environmental racism happens because Black communities serve as dumping grounds for things. So just so it's clear, and if there's any question, no colonies happen out of free will. No, there's not a sign-up list where people want to be colonies and want to be colonized, and there's a long list. So we do not do this voluntarily. We're not undereducated and over-incarcerated because we signed up for it or we want it or that's what we're looking for. And no colonies, therefore, can be maintained without some form of force. In the vast majority of those cases, probably all the cases, the force is overt. Military force in external colonies and police force in domestic colonies. So the police then are an occupying force in Black communities throughout the United States. I think it's important that we understand this, particularly as we talk about how we resolve the problems of policing in Black communities. We understand the police are an occupying force, and therefore the solution to the problems that we're having now and the flare-ups that we're having now is not to end racism, but to end the occupation and end occupation of black communities. There's no way we can organize towards ending racism. We can, however, organize towards ending occupation and ending colonial relationships, and that's what we need to be moving towards. So the police then are able to enforce conditions because of the force that they bring with them and the power of the state and the legitimacy of the state, but really because of the guns and the ability to put people in prison, they are able to enforce conditions of environmental racism, which are hazards in low-income communities, environmental hazards in low-income communities. But they also have the dual role then of serving, as many colonies do, as a dumping ground for products and also as a testing ground for products. And in this case, as it relates to police and police states, as a testing ground for police tactics and actions, police actions, the behaviors of police, which then would go out to broader communities eventually if they're tested properly and work out in low-income black communities. So who cares and what's the connection here? So the black communities then end up being the testing ground for police work and for certain police tactics and actions. And there are concerns about what the police are doing to the ecological movement here. Then the best way to know what the police are going to be doing towards ecological activists in 10 years is to look to see what police are doing in black communities today. That is the greatest insight you will have into what the police are going to be doing in the direction in which to do it. They're going because they're going to be able to test out those strategies and tactics and methods in low-income communities, low-income black communities that have very little political power to resist that and little support to resist outside of that. I'm very glad that Ben brought up stated that there's no epidemic of eco-incarceration. I think it's been a big deal, something I'm very concerned about. My partner has a childhood friend who had a high-profile case, was victimized by these unjust attacks. But in terms of rates, many people know United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And the incarceration rate is 716, which means out of 100,000 people, 716 are incarcerated in the United States, highest rate in the world. And though they don't give the breakdown in that way by race, the incarceration rate for blacks is 6 times higher than the incarceration rate for whites. So 716 is the highest in the world. If you were just to take the white rate, it would be somewhere around, they don't give the exact number, but somewhere around 600, which would keep the U.S., by the way, certainly in the top 10, but probably in the top 5, depending on how you add it. 600, which is the rate for arresting whites, 600 is the incarceration rate for whites in the United States. Extremely high, top 10 in the world. But at 6 times higher, that means the incarceration rate for blacks in the United States would be 3,500 or 3,600. It's somewhere just below 6 times. The highest rate in the world is 716. The incarceration rate for blacks in the United States is 3. I don't know what the incarceration rate is for environmental activists here. I'm pretty sure, however, it's not in the 3,000 range. And the arrests that are happening are not happening because of unusual actions which are taken, or taken actions even that are overtly illegal. And of course, the ecological activities that are environmental protection activities that are illegal because corporations make them illegal in order to protect their own financial interests. But these are things like jaywalking. These are things like standing around your own community that are getting large numbers of black people arrested. And if we're not able to put a stop to that kind of police state, we're not going to be able to put a stop to the kind of police state that we're seeing inside of organized communities, inside of activist communities, ecological, Occupy, or whatever they are. If we're not able to stop it there in black communities, we're not going to be able to stop it anywhere. So we're proposing in terms of this time and what we should be moving towards as we're seeing these protests against police brutality, is that the fundamental move at this time should be towards community control over police. The objective, the demand right now, Black Lives Matter, is an incredible sentiment and an incredible slogan. It is not, however, a demand. The demand for this time should be community control over the police. So what would that look like? Community control over police would mean then that local communities would be split up in districts, many of them already are, and then each one of those communities would be able to vote on whether they keep their existing police department or dump it and get a new police department. And then a civilian panel would run every aspect of the police. The civilian panel will be in charge of determining the priorities, the policies, and the practices of the police, which means that if the police are not following those priorities and they are not employing the policies and they are not engaging practices that the community supports, then the community would be able to fire those police. In the same way now that if the police don't arrest environmental activists when they're told to by the corporations, then those cops will be fired. If the police behave in ways that are counter to the interests of those communities, then those police would be fired as well. So this has to, of course, start because of this time and because of where the problem is the most egregious, must start with black community control, but ultimately must expand out beyond that so that each community would have control over its police rather than each corporation having control over its police. So if the police behavior is reflective of the people who are in power or those who are in charge of the police, then if we have community control over the police, then the police behavior should then reflect the needs and wants of the community. And if they don't, then that police force could easily be dispatched and replaced with people who are willing to do that. So what we're and this is, by the way, in terms of the connection with legal, it seems to me, is the ultimate expression of democracy. Is that communities get to decide who walks around with guns and has the ability to stop people and hold them and arrest them until prison abolition is done. So we're calling for support of black community control of police. Incidentally, in that we would have to, as part of that, deconstruct the very meaning of police in this society, not just take over the brutal and corrupt police that exists now. We have to deconstruct the meaning of police and redeploy it as a way that serves communities rather than one that harms communities. So we think that the best way to end the police state, and not only the police state, but the extent to which the police state is able to enforce the destruction of the environment, is to advance the cause of community control over the police. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I am Kyone Mallory, and I am sort of a mirror image here of Michael. I can tell you that I am Associate Professor of Environmental Philosophy at Villanova University, but I did my PhD and my doctoral work in environmental studies right here at the U of O, so it is awesome to be back at ELaw, where I participate a lot. But my specialization is not with thinking about the penal system or issues of incarceration, except for as a very deeply concerned citizen and somebody who's invested, both as an academic and a person, in issues concerning justice. But I do specialize in environmental justice, the theory and the practice of environmental justice, and I teach about this, as well as related fields like ecofeminism, another primary specialization, and green political theory. And so in thinking about this also, so what is it that I could contribute to this particular talk? And Panjati and I just spoke just a couple of days ago, and then I had a harrowing ride in from Philadelphia with two canceled flights. So I think I can, and I was literally here a half an hour before this panel. So the environmental justice movement. So what I think I would like to do is give some overview of how those of us who are environmental theorists, work in environmental ethics and environmental philosophy as academics, think about what the intersection between theory and praxis is as it is presented or as it manifests through the environmental justice movement, and what that dialectical or dialogical movement between the work of activists, the work of community organizers, the work of environmental justice advocates, and those who are thinking about what are the theoretical frameworks that do link things like, and this is what I'm thinking through out loud with you, do link things like prison reform, the horribly unequal rates of incarceration that we just heard all about between people of color and whites and other dominant groups, and other forms of discrimination, oppression, and our relations with the environment. So I just want to offer you a definition of environmental justice that comes straight from the U.S. environmental justice movement. And that is that the definition of their environment is where people live, work, play, learn, and worship. And what's significant about this definition is that it marks a departure from a more traditional environmentalism's understanding of the environment as privileging wilderness. The environment is this pristine, pure place that has old growth forests. Now, don't get me wrong, a lot of my research has been on the forest defense movement too, and it's something I completely support. And these are issues of justice. But thinking of environments as being only while places where there aren't people, or people, you know, the Wilderness Act actually says where man, quote unquote, the false universal there, man is a visitor who does not remain. Okay, so what this does is this gives us an idea of the environment or an environmental issue as only about preserving or protecting those places. And these are debates that have gone on within environmental movements for a lot of years, and I think we've made a lot of progress. But it especially appears in some versions, for example, of deep ecology, right? So a lot of the radical environmental movements, direct action environmental movements that identify themselves as with deep ecology, deep ecologists, it's about protecting wilderness. So there's been historically an understandable antipathy or antagonism tension between communities of color and other social justice movements and the quote-unquote mainstream environmental movement for reasons that I'm sure that most people in the room are aware. And so grappling with some of these tensions has been a task for both movements. All right, so in the interest of time here, so that there can be commentary and discussion, actually I will offer you a definition from my own work of environmental justice, another definition. It's the social movement that seeks to identify and rectify the ways in which certain members of the populace, the poor, communities of color, the very young and the elderly, women, disabled, and others who are marginalized in society are disproportionately and inequitably subjected to the health impairing effects of environmentally toxic industries and ecosystem destroying practices. And so I think that if we put, so think about the words of Paul and Max and Michael together and thinking about, okay, so the disparity and the difference in who it is that's being incarcerated and then who it is that's subjected to those, who's bearing the brunt of those deleterious effects, having a prison with arsenic in the well system or something like that and not being able to do anything about it. You know, so they're right there. That's where two forms of oppression have just come together, and that's what environmental justice theory and ecofeminist theory can really contribute to the conversation to make it a dialogue between various kinds of ideas, is this notion of intersectionality. So how do we think social justice and environmental justice together instead of thinking of the environment as something out there that needs to be saved and the places where people are is like these wasted wastelands, as it was mentioned in here, you know, that they're already fallen, they're already sullied, you know, so we have to say what's best. How do we think nature and culture together so that humans and environment or nature are not separate? So a couple of highlights here. Environmental justice historically draws from and contributes to both the civil rights, anti-racism movements, and environmental movements. That's its genealogy. And other radical and liberatory movements such as feminism, queer transgender activism, disability advocacy, anti-poverty movements. So like, as a theory, it poses a challenge to the isms, right? So the racism and the sexism and the classism and the speciesism, bringing the eco piece into it. And again, rejects that nature-culture dualism. Environment is not just out there. Nature's not just out there. It's also in the in-here worlds of our built environments, including prisons, obviously, are built. So in challenging all of these, it says that social and environmental problems have to be faced simultaneously. There's no such thing as saying, oh, well, we have to address this first. Okay? That first we have to solve poverty and crime and issues of unequal access to education, and then we'll think about clean water, or vice versa. Okay? But rather that because the problems are entangled together, they have to be addressed together. So again, on the theoretical level, that just became glaringly apparent to me on the ground level here. So I was thinking about the work of a philosopher, and he is a black philosopher. His name is Charles Mills, if anybody is familiar with his work. He wrote an article called Black Trash. And what he said, he's actually drawing on the work of Thomas Hobbes first, so for you law students here, you probably know the work of Hobbes, many of us. And drawing this analogy of the social body and the political body as being analogous to the human body in the various parts. So the Leviathan, the king, the authority is connected with the head. The appendages, the arms, are the enforcers. That would be the cops, right? So the political body and the human body have these analogs or correlates. And he says, well, if this is the case, then black people are literally the bowels and the excrement of society. Both are that and are the place where the and the waste is placed. Okay? Because
black people, specifically people of color, but specifically black people for Charles Mills, anchor the bottom of the racial hierarchy. So when I think about this, and I currently, and I lived in the Northeast, in the Mid-Atlantic, in Philadelphia. I live in Philadelphia, Camden, New Jersey, across the bridge, predominantly, overwhelmingly African-American, poster child for the environmental justice movement. That's not a good thing. Incredibly high rates of asthma, disabilities in children, low learning levels, and then every time there's a new, they're going to cite a new agency, a new industry, it doesn't go to Radnor, where my university is, out in the suburbs of Philadelphia. It goes to Camden. Okay, and the argument that this is not an accident. It's because of historical accretions of the inequalities. So, thinking again about intersectionality, I don't know. I would just say that this has been edifying, and I think that prisons are places. They're not wastelands, or at least they shouldn't be seen as that. And the people who are in prisons should not be seen as lost, but that's what that reflection is. And I think that the point about greenwashing too and co-opting. And I guess I just have one last quick comment, which is that there's a couple things that kind of bug me about the discussion about, if I can be commentator for a moment, about certainly common cause between eco-activists, especially those who are targets of police surveillance and the threats of these kinds of things, and people of color who are incarcerated or threatened with incarceration. But it made me think about how environmental justice activists exactly say, it's like maybe eco-activists and people of color are not really different communities, and people of color are eco-activists, but it looks different. It looks like education reform. It looks like community activism. It looks like grassroots activism done by women in their communities who don't understand themselves as activists or feminists, who say, I'm doing this for the sake of the health of my family. Eco-activism looks like getting jobs, and it looks like rebuilding housing in communities, okay? And it looks like participating in police reform commissions, okay? These are environmental issues. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Those are what I think the contributions can be.
So to all the tar sands blockaders in the room, I think we'd maybe start picturing what it would look like to blockade the school-to-prison pipeline. And to people who are interested in studying law and looking at areas of environmental law that are underdeveloped, I would like to figure out what it would take to start recognizing the existence of a prison as the environmental justice nightmare that it is. It's an industrial warehouse facility basically populated full of people who fit the criteria that the EPA has designated as environmental justice communities, probably to the 99%+. But those communities are actually not recognized by the census data that gets used in determining environmental justice issues. So we're just starting to scratch the surface of this, and we would love help to understand why that's happening and how to fight it and change it, and put this on the map of both the environmental movement and the criminal justice and prison abolition movement. Let's see, I took a note that there was a question about examples of community control or policing. When we start with that and then open it up to...
So a couple things real quick. I just want to make sure that we're going to answer the question directly. I want to make sure we don't get into a thing of where we have to have an example of it existing. There's nothing wrong with us creating something all new. With that said, the best examples of community control over the police does not happen in the United States, like the best examples of housing or other social phenomenon. It happens outside of the United States, where local communities are given some level of autonomy over a certain class of interactions that happen among people. So, for example, in many countries where there is... But local communities have some level of control over their own customary rights, customary law, have some control over their own areas. Certain classes of illegal activity are not interfered with by the broader police, but are handled inside of the community using customary law. In the United States, I think there's two examples. Neither one of them are perfect examples, but exist nonetheless. Inside of Native American reservations, again, certain class of laws are handled by Native American reservations. Police, not by broader police, although there's lots of problems with that example. We're not trying to replicate, obviously, the reservation system for a number of reasons. But then the second one, which has problems in a different
in a different way. In the Crown Heights section of New York, the Hasidic Jewish community has an arrangement with the police where they have their own force and they're able to stop people who are riding their bikes or walking through and interrogate them. If you look on YouTube, you can see videos. It's a really, really abusive employment of this kind of community control. But there's many videos of black men riding through this community and then being tackled and held down on the ground by the Hasidic Jewish police department, for lack of a better term there, and being questioned as to why they're there. And the New York City Police Department does not interfere in them policing their own community. So that's not the kind of police that we want to have. But they can't say that we handle all the crimes, we can't handle the crime, because that's not true. There are places where they do allow that to happen.
And there's another thing very quickly to add to this, and that is the restorative justice conversations that are happening all over the country. There's actually a lot in a lot of communities. I participate in one where I live. It's about... It's a restorative justice conferencing model. So we have this big, long table with 20 people there, represents all the organizations in the community, the resources of the community, mental health, physical health, academics, including law enforcement, and we deal with kids. And the goal is how to keep the kids out of the system, because the best way to stay in the system is to enter it as a kid. And that is going on all over the place.
And that was Ben Rosenfeld, attorney and board member of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, speaking on a panel from the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference on the ecology of a police state. We also heard from Paul Wright, founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, Max Rameau, director of the Center for Pan-African Development, and Keon Mallory, associate professor of environmental philosophy at Villanova University. The moderator was Panagioti Tsolkas, and the program was recorded by Paul Rowland in March. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Today's guest is David